May it please the court, good morning.
Good morning.
My name is John Briley. I was appointed by this court to represent Russell C. Washington Jr. on this appeal. I was also trial counsel, but trial was limited to a motion to suppress with the understanding that if Mr. Washington did not prevail on that motion, he would take a Rule 11 plea of preserving the right to appeal. This case presents two relatively simple issues as far as the statement of the issue goes, but they're somewhat complicated in our view. On the motion to suppress, recognizing that the standard for probable cause for a police officer is rather low on the scale, we nevertheless believe that, submit that the officers did not have probable cause to search the vehicle at once they had stopped Mr. Washington for on a admitted traffic law violation.
They smelled alcohol, right?
Yeah, that was conceded, yeah. That was not disputed.
And then they saw alcohol, right?
Well, that is disputed.
They saw some amount of red.
They saw liquid. The police officers believed they saw a puddle on the floor, mostly on the rear floor.
It smelled like alcohol, right?
That's what they said. And they had a cup with residue in it that they said had the alcohol smell associated with it. But it was not determined that the cup was not, at least I don't believe the district court judgment.
So what would it have taken for them to have reason to search the automobile in your view?
Well, I believe that if it could...
More than residue, if there had been a little bit more than residue in the cup? Or a stronger smell of, I don't understand what
I believe that if this would be a different case if the officers had, or if the judge, district court judge, had made a finding that there was liquid in the cup and that the cup was in the possession of Mr. Washington, which would be pretty hard, I believe, for the sole occupant of a car to dispute a probable cause finding that he was in possession. A probable cause determination that if it's in the car, had liquid in it, that he's in possession. But
it was in the car and it had residue in it. So the difference right now is residue and since the amount.
Yes.
Of the alcohol.
Yeah.
It wasn't reasonable for the police to think that maybe the puddle on the floor that was smelling like alcohol might have been in the cup and that he might have emptied it?
Well,
is that unreasonable? We're just looking for reasonableness right here. Right?
Well, I think that's a reasonable, practical conclusion. The issue is whether that gives rise to a police officer, giving the police officer the authority to make an arrest of that person if there's a puddle on the floor. And I submit that this is not an area where there's very much judicial authority because it's a... relatively low-level offense, and there aren't too many that I know of decisions by the D.C. Court of Appeals on this issue, but I submit...
He's driving between 2:30 and 3:30 in the morning with no headlights on, right?
That's correct. That was it. That was conceded, yeah. That was not disputed.
That's kind of hard to do, isn't it? No headlights on?
Lights? Yeah, well, 2:30
in the morning. Just an impairment of judgment? I mean, see...
Well, it's an impairment of judgment or oversight. His testimony was that he had, his position was that he had dropped people off and he may have stopped the car, turned off the motor, and then restarted the car and not turned on the lights. He hadn't traveled very far. His witness, whom he had seen shortly before the encounter with the police officers, got on the scene pursuant to a phone call between her and the appellant while he was in the course of being stopped by the police. So she was there within very, very few minutes. So that, but the...
And what is that intended to show?
Well, that he had not traveled very far. And that, to go to your question about driving around with no headlights on, showing very poor judgment, I don't believe he had... there's any indication he had traveled any great distance and he may just have not mechanically turned on the lights, which I think is not an uncommon or unusual, totally unusual experience. So with respect to that, I believe that the ruling that is presented to this court for review was based on the judge's inference that Mr. Washington had emptied the cup himself on the floor of the car. And we would dispute that the legitimacy of the judge making that inference based on what limited evidence there was. With respect to the sentencing issue, the transcript shows, the record shows, that the judge admitted that she would have the discretion to consider the the argument presented by Mr. Washington, that given the government's somewhat documented decision that it was worthy, he was worthy of prosecution in the federal court as opposed to the local court, that while she had the discretion to consider how he might have been treated under the D.C. voluntary sentencing guidelines, she never did, the judge never did any analysis of.
What should she have done in your view?
Well, we submit the first thing she should have done is that she should have required the government to establish some rationale, document a record as to why, because why Mr. Washington was prosecuted in the district court.
I guess I don't understand that argument just in terms of, you know, the statute gives the U.S. attorney the authority to make those decisions.
Well,
and this court has acknowledged that.
Yeah, the argument is presented here because of the disparity in the sentencing. It's a monumental decision for an individual. It's a
But we've held it isn't a violation of due process.
No, it's not a violation of due process, but under the evolution of sentencing decisions that have come about since Booker, I think it's clear that the courts are required to do a more detailed analysis of this in a sentencing decision as to why this.
That's why I asked you the question I did, because if the judge sitting as a federal judge is at sentencing, the Supreme Court has indicated what the judge has to do, to start with the sentencing guidelines and then look to the statutory factors. Isn't that correct?
That's correct.
So I want to understand what you think the error was by the district court judge here. Should she have averted back to the D.C. guidelines? Is that your point? Or she should have said at some point, I'm not going to look at the federal guidelines, I'm simply going to apply the D.C. guidelines?
She should have. I submit she should have. Our expectation and our Mr. Washington's hope was that she would actually apply the D.C. guidelines, because the decision that had been made by the prosecutor to bring the matter into the district court as opposed to the local court, when the judge agreed that this was not an uncommon experience, that frequently the government does make a decision to go one way, one court, as opposed, and there are cases that go to the other court, then there's no rationale as to why what turns out to be a sentencing determination is allowed to be made by the prosecutor instead of by the court.
So is the error, I just need to be clear what the error is here. I understand your client wanted the lower sentence,
yeah,
but I want to understand the legal error. Is it that, in your view, the district court was obligated, when she went through the federal guidelines and then the statutory factors, to revert back to the D.C. guidelines, or to start out saying, because this is really a local offense, I'm not even going to deal with the federal guidelines. This is a case that should be considered.
Well, I believe that, following your line of thought, I believe it would have been better, and I believe it was error for the judge not to have considered the propriety of this being, first of all, a local offense as well as a federal offense under two statutes that are virtually the same in language. And this issue was presented by Mr. Washington to her, and there was no analysis done.
What's your response to the government's position? You know, that the district court heard the argument, said she had discretion, and then said, well, there's seven convictions here. Your client hasn't spent substantial time in jail. I think an appropriate sentence is as follows.
Well, that's an analysis under the criteria set forth by, I think it's 3553, I believe, but the legal error is that Mr. Washington presented an argument. The judge admitted she had the discretion to consider that argument, and then she failed to analyze the basis and the propriety of my client's argument.
But I guess what I'm asking you is, when she says things like, you know, your client has 7 convictions, he hasn't spent substantial time in prison, he's just living a life of crime, I think it's appropriate that he serve a substantial period.
Well, I would agree, but I submit that the substantial a sentence under the DC voluntary guidelines would have satisfied what the judge was talking about. That is a substantial period, because the government pointed out my presentation didn't take effect of his prior record, and he would have gotten probably a 36-month sentence under the DC voluntary guidelines.
Is it your argument that the government, as a matter of law, is obliged to state its reasons for pursuing sentencing under the federal guidelines as opposed to local law?
I submit in this situation that would be
as a matter of law, is the government required to do that whenever there's a choice to be made? Must they state on the record?
Well, the answer to that right now is not yet, but I submit that it would be appropriate and should be required. That would be a just result.
I'm just trying to understand. As with Judge Rogers, what is your argument? So you're asking for law to be made. There is no such legal requirement that the government state. I understood your argument to be that there is no such legal requirement, and that in the absence of a smoking gun, something to suggest that what the government has done is plainly arbitrary and wholly inappropriate. There's nothing that the district court is obliged to do. Right? You'd like the law to be changed.
I would like the law to be not so much changed, because this is not changing any principle of law. This is getting into an area in which there is no law one way or the other.
Well, that would be changing the law.
Well, that would be...
It would be imposing a legal requirement where none exists right now.
It would not, but this is, I believe, it's similar to other cases in sentencing issues where defendants raise issues that affect the sentence, and the courts, the Supreme Court, say that when a person presents an issue...
The problem is for you is that the prosecutor has the authority to decide which way to proceed. And absent something on the record to suggest, I don't even know what case says that.
Well,
there may be one or two that suggest that absent something on the record that suggests this is just an extraordinary move by the prosecutor. There's no requirement for the prosecutor even to explain why. I think they did in this case explain.
Well, my answer to that is...
Was their reason unreasonable?
I'm sorry?
Was their reason unreasonable?
They never stated a reason.
I think they did. There was a multi-agency attempt to deal with guns in the city.
Well, that's a proffer by the prosecuting attorney. There's no record as to...
Well, but they don't have any obligation in the first place.
Not. Well, they should, I submit.
Okay.
They should, and
we're back to the same point.
It goes back to...
You'd like some law to be made.
I would like some law to be made on the question of the disparity. It goes back to this results in an unfair, unjustified disparity. If the government could justify a disparity, we'd have a different case.
The D.C. voluntary guidelines are voluntary, right?
They are voluntary because they are established with the caveat that judges will not be faulted for...
So they're even less than advisory, right? I mean, they're...
Well, I suppose that could be said, but they...
I mean, there are no presumptions created by falling within the guidelines, for example.
That's correct. If there are no further questions, I'll submit.
So you're trying to, as I understand, just trying to be clear about your argument here, that while you could, under the federal guidelines, ask for a departure or a variance, you're saying that the law ought to enable you to get that same benefit without meeting the burdens associated with those procedures under the federal guidelines?
Well, if the government had made a better showing as to why it chose to prosecute Mr. Washington this way when it prosecutes many other people other way, yes.
assume for the moment that the government doesn't have to make any showing. Congress has already made that decision that it has discretion to choose. And this court has said their choice does not result in a violation of due process. I mean, you may not like it. You may think it's unfair, but we need something to grab a hold of.
Well, I believe that the due process theory would be applicable here because of the disparity. And that is what we were relying on, the disparity.
I didn't see that in your brief. Is that right?
Well, I pointed out that if, in my brief, that if Mr. Washington had, if the judge had looked at the D.C. voluntary guidelines, had actually considered applying the D.C. voluntary guidelines, she could have imposed a sentence, in my presentation to her, as low as 24 months. And she did not, I believe she sentenced Mr. Washington at the bottom of the federal guideline.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
We'll give you a minute on rebuttal.
Good morning. Elizabeth Dinello for the United States. On the suppression issue, four factors together provide probable cause supporting appellant's arrest for possession of an open container of alcohol or POCA. First, as appellant's counsel acknowledges, the cup in the rear seat cup holder was not dry. There was some liquid in it. To be sure, not a lot of liquid.
So this is constructive possession.
It is constructive possession at the moment of arrest, but the POCA offense could have been based on actual possession, as I'll get to in a moment.
On the argument that he poured the liquid out?
Exactly, which is supported by three other facts that were before the district court. Second factor, I've mentioned the cup, the second factor is that the puddle of liquid was located directly behind where appellant was seated. Third, the whole car reeked of alcohol. The officers could smell the alcohol even as they were standing outside the car. And fourth, as appellant was driving the 1 to 2 blocks after the police had signaled him to stop, he was making shoulder motions, which the officers described as his shoulders were dropping, his head was moving, his arms were moving. This is in the suppression hearing transcript at pages 9, 32, 52, and 53. Totality of the circumstances is the basis for probable cause, and based on the totality of these facts, police reasonably could conclude that the puddle of liquid on the floor was alcohol that, until recently, in fact, until just before appellant realized he was being pulled over by the police, had been in the cup. And so the police, therefore, had probable cause to arrest him for POCA.
The shoulder motions indicate what?
They support the inference that he was getting rid of the liquid in the cup. And that's why when the police stopped the car, the cup was almost empty and the liquid was on the floor.
How does that indicate he was getting... Sure, it could have just been listening to some music on the radio and shaking. I don't understand how it...
Well, given that he's being... Given the timing of these shoulder motions, Your Honor, it's unlikely that he was feeling in a particularly relaxed mood as the police were pulling him over. And the fact that he's making these motions, the puddle is on the floor, the cup is empty, taken together, these factors support the inference that, as the district court found, he had discarded the liquid from the cup. So going back to your initial question, Judge Rogers, the POCA could be based on a finding of actual possession before the police actually arrived at the car.
And where was the cup before arguably any liquid was poured out of it? It was in the back seat?
We don't know where the cup was before any liquid was poured out of it. The inference could be that he was holding the cup, he was drinking the cup. When he saw the police, he poured the liquid out. And indeed, after the stop, the police discovered the liquid appeared to originate at the feet of the driver in the front part of the seat and had made its way toward the back part of the seat.
None of this defeats your argument, but I thought there was evidence that the cup was in the cup holder in the back.
In the rear of the back seat. And that would be the inference that he dumps it out and then tries to get that cup away from him by putting it in the back seat.
As opposed to that he was drinking it, but that he had some people in the car.
Well, his claim was that he had people in the car. The police were not required to credit that.
No, I understand, but I mean, the cup was in the back seat. It wasn't up with the driver. That's all I'm getting at.
Right, at the time of the stop. We don't know where the cup was at the time the police first signaled.
Was in the rear seat. The evidence only showed the cup was in the rear seat after it was emptied?
After it was emptied. The only evidence about the cup's location comes after the stop. Appellant has not addressed the search of the car in oral argument. We'll rest on our brief on that unless the court has questions. And then on the sentencing issue, the district court agreed with appellant that it had discretion to sentence in accordance with the D.C. voluntary sentencing guidelines. And the court nonetheless believed that a sentence of 57 months, which was at the bottom end of the federal guidelines range, best serves sentencing goals.
Well, let me ask you two questions. One, the judge said something about she thought she had authority if the government had abused its discretion in bringing this case to the federal court.
Then
she could apply the D.C. sentencing guidelines. Or did she make this separate argument that even if it was properly before her, she still had discretion to apply the D.C. guidelines?
The judge makes two separate statements and separate parts of the transcript. At page 4, when the defense first raises the issue, this is obviously at the beginning of the sentencing hearing, that the judge could rely on the D.C. sentencing guidelines, defense counsel says, I think the court has discretion to start its analysis with the federal guidelines and end it with the D.C. guidelines. And the judge responds, something to the effect of, yes, I agree, I would have discretion to do that. Later on, there's a discussion about the propriety of the transfer. And I'm not sure I'm getting the correct order here, but in the course of that discussion, the prosecutor does put on the record a rather detailed proffer about what went on behind the scenes of the transfer. And the judge indicates that if there were an abusive use of prosecutorial power, she would have the authority to intervene, but she doesn't find that based on this record. So,
could I just ask you conceivably what that could be? I mean, I suppose if you were bringing all people of a certain faith or race or something like that.
I think a discriminatory reason, absolutely. And that was in the language of Mills, the court talks about exercise of discretion that's rational and non-discriminatory. So certainly if transfer was based on a discriminatory reason, then absolutely a district court would not only have authority but really an obligation to intervene. It'd be a little harder to show an irrational use of discretion, but conceivably there could be some case. Here there are reasons given. They are rational reasons, and the trial court certainly was correct in finding no impropriety in the transfer. And given that, then the court in sentencing appellant did everything it was supposed to do. It determines appellant's guidelines range, and then it goes through the 3553 factors really in a lot more detail than was even necessary, but the court makes clear that it understands its post-Booker obligation to consider the case in the context of 3553, and after going through that analysis, finds that the guideline sentence of 57 months is appropriate.
Well, here's my hypothetical. Suppose instead of imposing the sentence she did, the district court, after going through everything you pointed out, said, but because I think this is really a local offense, I'm going to apply the D.C. guidelines, but I'm not going to impose 24 months, I'm going to impose 36 months, all right? The defendant is not satisfied, so he comes up here and appeals. Is the government going to take the same position that it was a proper exercise of the judge's sentencing authority?
It's not clear that the government would not take a cross appeal in that case.
What would be the basis for the cross appeal?
And we have not reached a position on this, but an argument could be made that as a matter of law, a district judge errs in considering a local sentence as the basis for imposing a certain federal sentence. And the theory behind that argument is that the sentencing disparities that a district court is required to consider under 3553A6 refers only to disparities within the federal system, and that judges are taxed with not creating further disparities within the federal system by getting out of the federal system in order to match up sentences with state regimes. So that would be the basis of the argument. I'm not saying necessarily that we would claim error, but there would be a basis for that argument.
But under the federal system, doesn't the judge have the authority to reduce it below the sentencing guideline?
The judge essentially can do whatever he or she wants, post-Booker. But the question is whether Congress intends for sentences that the considerations a judge can take into account do not include creating further disparities within the sentencing system, that 3553 may cabin a judge's discretion specifically to try and make sentences match up with state sentences. Now, a judge could find for other reasons that a lower sentence is appropriate. For instance, the judge may well find that, for any routine number of cases, that the guidelines themselves are too severe, but whether specifically the state court system is what the judge should be looking at may or may not be appropriate. And furthermore, in this jurisdiction, if a judge does that, then it essentially does an end run around the prosecutor's exercise of discretion that the court has recognized in making these transfer decisions.
And it supplants the congressional judgment with that of some other legislative body, doesn't it? Isn't that the real problem with that?
Well, it's both. I mean, the court has recognized that sentencing is not confined solely to the judiciary, but that the other branches of government have a role in determining the defendant's sentence. But just going back,
except as you said, the district court judge has the authority to reduce.
It does have the authority to reduce, but if that reduction means that the prosecutor's proper decision to prosecute in federal court, which the court recognized is appropriate even because of the more severe penalties that federal court may offer, that if that lower sentence, in a sense, undermines that prosecutorial discretion, then there may be a problem.
I mean, it seems to me what you're arguing is that a district court judge should not be so stupid as to indicate that as the reason and just say, all things considered, I think much lower is appropriate here. But obviously, a district court judge is likely to notice that what the sentence would be in this unique jurisdiction where you can come either place is substantially lower than what the guidelines produce, and that would certainly affect. So you're saying all a district court judge has to do to avoid your U.S. attorney's concerns is to clothe it differently. It seems silly to me, but I don't know why a district court judge in this jurisdiction, given the way we operate here as opposed to other U.S. attorneys who do not have the same authority you have, could not notice and even honestly say, well, I happen to notice you can go either place here for exactly the same offense, and the disparities are enormous, and I look at the rest of what this person has done, and I'm putting it down on the lower end.
That's a risk a district court may endure if a district court chooses to be so explicit in the sentence. I pose that only as a risk because, as I say, we have not reached a firm position on how we would approach a case like that. There are other instances where it does
advise the district court judges
to keep their mouths shut, and that's not the only instance where judges are well advised not to say more than necessary.
So you don't have a view if the district court decided that she was going to be forthcoming and if she said, you know, I find the congressional sentencing here too severe, and I prefer what the D.C. sentencing range would be, and so I'm going to go with that. Would that be a problem?
As I've expressed, it's problematic. Mm-hmm. Whether it would be a basis for an argument on appeal that the judge erred, I don't know. Mm-hmm. But also, just going back to...
You seem to be protecting the prosecutor's right. You seem to be more interested in protecting the prosecutor's discretion than maybe Congress's here, right? But I guess I understand
it's
that.
It's really a combination. I mean, obviously, our interest is in...
Sure.
Our own branch.
I understand that.
And also, the prosecutor's discretion is something that the court has upheld in Mills and in Dockery, which is also a helpful case, illustrative of the concerns that this court has expressed about not undermining the prosecutor's discretion at sentencing. Just following up finally on one point suggested by Judge Edwards' question earlier is just to clarify that, and perhaps I'm overreading your hypothetical, is that remember, too, that in this case we're not talking about a set sentence in D.C. Superior Court because the statutory sentence is no necessarily more severe. Here we're talking about, as Judge Griffith pointed out in an earlier question, purely voluntary guidelines. Now, to be sure, most judges do apply the guidelines in Superior Court, and most judges probably sentence within the guidelines, but that's not to say there's any guarantee that any particular defendant, or particularly this defendant, would have received a sentence lower than what he got in this court. Unless this court has any further questions, we'd ask it to affirm the judgment of the district court. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Judge Rogers. I would just like to point out that this issue of the sentencing was raised in a sentencing memorandum filed by Mr. Washington. Did not something that came up at the beginning of the hearing. The government and the court was on notice that Mr. Washington was making a claim that there was a disparity that needed to be addressed, and they didn't, the government didn't see fit to respond. And if I may, the government is argument is based on what a prosecutor said by way of record evidence as to what happened to get into federal court. And if I may, I practice in Superior Court, and I can, from my own experience, remain mystified as to why certain cases are brought here and certain other cases are brought in Superior Court involving the exact same offense with people with the same kind of records. So that, and with respect to the argument about federal system and local, I would point out, I would argue that the in this unique jurisdiction, what happens in the Superior Court, what happens in the U.S. Attorney's Office more especially, it's all part of the federal system. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much.